You're listening to Wake Up with Patty Catter, where we're overcoming trials with triumphs. Now, here's your host, Patty Catter.
Hi, everybody. Thanks again for joining me this week. Today, I have Tom Satterley on the show. Welcome to my show, Tom.
Thanks, Patty. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. I'm really glad that you showed up and you're here to talk about your story. Really, you have a remarkable story. So I'm going to go ahead and let you introduce yourself to my guests and just tell my listeners a little bit about who you are, where you're from, how you grew up. And then I really want to hear your experiences. You're a Delta operator. You were in the military. So I want to hear all about that. A lot of my listeners are military, so they're going to be super excited to hear about you.
Awesome. Yeah, I grew up small town Indiana. I'm zero plans in life. And then one of my friends in high school joined the military and took off while I was building houses. And he came back from basic training and told me how great it was. He was off to Germany. And it hit me at that moment, that day, actually, that I'm going to either be stuck here swinging a hammer and building houses or you know, as a kid, you get 5 minutes of thought and then you're off to the next thought. So it was one of those, I can get out of here. I can do the same thing he's doing. So that day I joined the military, and that was late summer of 85. And in early February of 86, I went to basic training at Fort Leonard Wood here, where I live now in Missouri. And I ended up going to Germany for the first 3 years. And then the rest of my 22 years were spent in special operations. Just due to what had happened to me in Germany, I had bumped into a couple people that knew of different schools to go to that were cooler, like French Commando School and German Ranger School. And that gave me a different taste versus sitting in the motor pool every Monday and doing the same thing and never going anywhere. And though I was in Germany, we were always planning to blow up all the bridges in Germany to stop the Russian horde back in the day. It was still boring. We still didn't have money to do any training. So when my platoon sergeant took us to a couple of different places and I got to go to, like I said, French Commando School and German Ranger School, I decided I want something more. I'm not going to get out. I'm going to stay in. And so when I hit my 3 year mark, I reenlisted for the Green Berets just to get back to Fort Bragg. And then when I got there and made that, I was approached by some guys in the unit who told me after the Green Beret selection while I was in language school that, hey, we think you should try out for this next thing. I'm like, okay, that sounds cool too. Let's do that. And I made that in early 91.
Wow. So there's a little funny story. My husband was stationed at Fort Bragg when he was in the Army. And when he first went there, I was pretty naive. So when I met him, he was a Marine Corps vet and he was a cop for 10 years. He was into the Army. And I'm actually really naive at that point. And I'm driving through Fort Bragg and I'm like, hey kids, let's go for a ride. We're going to go down these trails nobody's ever been down. And then I start seeing these signs like warning, do not enter, you know, all these crazy things. And I see these guys out in the distance and they're all like scruffy and these huge beards and stuff. And one of them starts yelling like, you're not supposed to be back here. Turn around. So later I go back home and I'm talking to my husband's friends and he's like, man, you know, you're not supposed to be out there. Those were the first days that I started learning about Delta.
That's funny. You know, you hear so many stories about the guys out there and the stories are so much bigger than reality, which is fun. I heard it called the Black Chapel, you know, behind the fence, things like that. And I'm like, oh, those are neat that I heard later in life. Because I didn't know anything about the unit when I signed up. It was just one of those, I showed up, I'm like, well, what is this place? I had no idea. But so many stories of people bumping in, you know, and people, you shouldn't be around here. It's like, okay, well, then you should have a fence up or something if I shouldn't be here, right? So it's funny that people claim more territory than they really own out there in Fort Bragg sometimes. Like, this is all secret because everybody loves a secret.
It is true. It's so funny. And oh my gosh, my kids used to play all sorts of games when they were little, you know, like find the different places the terrorists can break in at the gate and things like that.
Those are fun. I used to play those games too, like look for the ways in, like I could get in there, you know. Yeah. So that's actually a good job to get. There's called Red Cell. People can actually, and I've done it before for different organizations where you can practice breaking into their facility and then show them what's wrong. And that can be dangerous at times because they don't tell anybody that you're doing it except high level people. So it can get sketchy trying to practice that Red Cell stuff where you're showing people where their weaknesses are.
Yeah. I don't think I'll just go in and play. So how in the world did you think that you're just going to go from, you know, swinging this hammer, as you said, And I know you said it was kind of a process. You wanted to kind of do something else besides sit around and paint rocks, probably, I'm guessing. So tell me, what was it like when you were going through some of your training once you started getting into different special ops training?
You know, once you start removing those obstacles of the mental things that you thought, I'll never make that. Oh, I can't do that. Or those guys are so much better than me, or I'm not that good. Once you get past that obstacle, that's yourself, you realize, like the military has changed obstacle course to confidence course. It's the same course. You just don't talk about the obstacles in the way because it's a negative thought process. You talk about the confidence you get when you go over those obstacles. And so that every school I went to gave me another boost of confidence. Like, well, I can do that. Well, I got away with that. I can really do this, you know? And, oh, wow, that doesn't kill you. So I can keep going. And I used to just tell myself they wouldn't have me do it if it could kill me. So I'll just dive right in and not worry about it. And I was wrong, but that's what kept me going, right? You could die doing it. And a lot of people do die in training, but it's one of those, I told myself that, you know, they wouldn't let me do it if it was that dangerous, right? So I just, everything they said to do, I just jumped. I'd dive right in and do it. And it was exciting. And every time I won, right, I didn't die. I kept going, and you get more and more confidence. And I just kept going at everything. The schools would line up. I would seek out other training opportunities just to grow and learn more, because I always never felt good enough. Like the imposter syndrome, like, how did I get here? I lived that way. And looking at all the people that you're surrounded by, these athletes, these warriors, these, you know, it's a Super Bowl, whatever, everybody calls it something, the highest of everything. You're like, man, I don't deserve to be here. And so you struggle with that the whole time. And what that does is it drives you to do more things, to feel better, feel stronger, feel more powerful. And that's just what I kept doing. And then, you know, you don't realize that what you're doing is telling yourself the whole time you're not good enough. So mentally I'm hearing you're not good enough. So when that all ends and there's no more training to go to, and there's no more, you know, hanging out with your bros and going to work, you sit back with the memories left of, I wasn't good enough, was I? I just kept trying to be better the entire time. But the training gives you that confidence to do everything in combat that you probably wouldn't do if you thought about it.
That's really interesting. I never really thought about it, but you're talking about something actually none of my guests have ever talked about. And I've had a lot of veterans on my show over the last 16, 17 years. And I don't think any of us have talked about that, you know, not feeling good enough. And that's why they keep going. But if you really break down their stories, it kind of does boil down to that. So tell me a little bit about first of all, what's one of your biggest memories, I guess, in the military, whether a great memory, a challenging one, what is the number one memory that sticks out to you?
You know, my number one memory that as soon as you start asking was popping into my head was sitting on a bed in Somalia the night of 3 October. We'd started early in that afternoon, and it's now dark at night, and the volume of fire in the city was so great, in and out, and our house was being picked apart by RPG fire, rocket propelled grenade fire, and it was just blowing our walls down and injuring our men. And my team leader came into the room at one point. I was sitting on the bed with pulling guard out of a window, and I asked him, I said, hey, are they going to make it? You know, they were coming to try to rescue us. We were trapped there and ended up being trapped there for 18 hours. And I said, are they going to make it? And he looked at me, and he just kind of, I don't know, and turned around and left. And that struck me to this day. It I think of it that I needed a motivational speech then, right, to keep me going. And what he gave me was the truth. And he didn't know. That was his fear speaking as well. And he was just being honest instead of filling me full of lies and crap that wasn't going to happen. And I just remember sitting there with a sinking feeling of, I'm not going to make it. We're not going to make it. And he didn't want to tell me that. And that kind of built me up to, that gave me the ability to shake off the fear and to shake off any hesitation that I might have had, and just give me that confidence of, well, if I'm gone, I'm going to do everything I can do to help anybody I can help out and take out as many as I can before I'm gone. And that kind of helped me get through that night. But that's kind of what screwed me up the rest of my life, you know, up to this point, even in my life, where that sinking feeling of it's over. It's truly over. And at that point is where I lost empathy and compassion for many, many years of my life, because in my mind, when I made it out alive, when I really truly thought I was going to die, I told myself that'll never happen again. That can never happen again. So I have to train harder. I took the blame on myself as an individual that I need to train harder so I can get out of that situation. Which led me to my number two point in the military, where it happened again in Iraq, and I was in charge this time. And it wasn't to the extent of it was as it was in Somalia, but it was one of those, here it goes again, and I'm in charge now, and I'm calling Black Hawk down over the radio versus the youngest guy, one of the youngest guys on the team, who had no responsibility. And so that made it a close number two, because I'm in charge of everyone now, and their souls are under my command and my, you know, my responsibility. So that hurt a lot harder. But that memory of being out of control and not in charge was my number one feeling of, I'm going to die and I'm never going to go home.
When you were in Iraq, where were you?
Everywhere. I mean, my sector that I was responsible for was Baghdad and south and west towards Fallujah and Ramadi. Mm-hmm. But we were all over Iraq. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know a lot about the Somalian War. I know my husband does. I was briefly talking to him before. He remembers when he was in the Marine that was in the Marines that was going down. How long were you in the military? Because I'm sitting here trying to add up the years and I'm like, man, I know you weren't in Vietnam, but you were in a while, hot minute.
25 years.
All right. Wow. Wow. So did you have a family?
Several. I gave them up each time. I was married 10 years ish. When I joined, I married pretty soon, actually right after basic training. I was one of those, I'm never going to see a woman again. I don't know what, young and excited and dating. And I was off to Germany. Let's get married. I got married and that lasted 10 years. Basically lasted up till after Somalia. Probably a couple years after Somalia, everything broke down. And then shortly after that, there was a short marriage. And then after that, I got married again for another 10 years-ish. And we had a son who's now 24. And it was one of those where I just kept choosing my career. You know, when you put so much into something and that's all you think about and you're young and you've been traumatically injured and your emotions are not mature. And I was just kind of choosing my life, my military career over any family, you know, which I completely and utterly regret now to this day. But it was just, I had a family and I think it took a toll on every one of them, obviously. And it took its toll on me as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're kind of trained like that, right? You're married to the military first and then your family.
Yeah. You know, you get the most satisfaction out of it because you go to work and you're contributing to something and they're contributing to what you do and you don't have to pay bills with them. You're not raising kids with them. The hardest thing to do, right, is to teach part of you into somebody how to be a human and instead of following a manual on how to go to combat and keeping each other alive. So that becomes, you know, you bond the most when you struggle the most and the most adversity. And me and my wife have not been through combat together. So it's hard to bond as much as you do with some people who you might die next to. So you do tend to lean towards the teams more, which is, you know, what we do in our nonprofit now is it's not what you do, right? That's not what you do. Your family has to be number one, always.
Tell me about your nonprofit.
Yeah, All Secure Foundation. We help special operations, active duty, and veterans and their families work through relationship issues, post-traumatic stress, and to understand what it does to them. And then give them modalities of healing or send them to places that do different modalities of healing that we've gone through that help them recover as a family. And we tell them if the veteran or the active duty individual is not ready to get help, which many, many, many times we're not, that the spouse can start anyway. A lot of people teach them, you know, the spouse can't go unless the military member goes. It's like, why are we tied to that? It's a family still, right? And if one is healed, they can help the other heal. So mm-hmm. We kind of started focusing on the families first.
Mm-hmm. So you say we are, did you get remarried or?
Yes. My wife now, Jen, been married. We've been together 10 years now. And she started the foundation. She worked with me after retirement. We met after retirement and I was at my worst. I mean, I was literally at my worst. I was 50 pounds heavier than I am now. I was like, I don't care about anybody or the world, but I had skills and people wanted to pay for that. And she was videoing and she came in to do some videoing of training and we ended up meeting and becoming friends and then setting up, co-founding an organization that trains special operations people to go to war. We were the last stop that they would see before they deployed overseas. And we would throw at them everything as real as we possibly could that we'd seen overseas. And people weren't coming back. And Jen wasn't built for that. She was like, where's Bob? Well, he didn't make it. Well, where's Mike? Well, he didn't make it either. You know, and there were people would die in training. And she just after several years is got to the point of, I can't do this anymore. I want to help them come home. I don't want to prepare them to go away. That's not what I'm built for. So she pulled out and stood up the foundation, All Secure. And I continued working for another year and a half to make money so we could eat food. And then she ended up building it to a point where she could bring me on full time. Found some sponsors that said, look, we want to be your admin sponsor. We want to be like your business partner. We don't want to just donate. So they set both of our salaries. They told me that I had to come off of work and go full time on the foundation and pour my soul into it. And then basically paid all of our admin fees for everything we do up to this point still now. So we could tell everyone else that 100% of their donations goes directly to the programs to help people, and kind of kicked it off. And we just started, because I think first we became a resource library to make it easier for people to find resources to get help, because it was so hard for me to find things. And then we validated what worked and we videoed it and posted it so people could feel more comfortable about trying new things. And then we continued to write about it. And then we started to host our own retreats where we'd have 10 to 12 couples come in on weekends for a 4-day retreat and work with our licensed clinical social workers on relationships and how to identify what post-traumatic stress does, so both members of that relationship can understand it and ease the tensions and help that curiosity of what's wrong with me. Spouse is like, am I crazy? You act crazy. When I tell you about it, you freak out on me. And it's like, this really happens and nobody can understand unless they live in it. And so our counselors or coaches, I'll call them over state lines, are coaches, and they help people understand that you can work together on this versus, you know, fighting with each other against the enemy, but yet you're fighting with each other versus, hey, we want you to fight together against that enemy, which is, you know, your emotions and how you feel and everything else that causes you to behave poorly at home.
One thing that you must feel pretty good about, though, is she did see you at your worst and you were 50 pounds heavier.
I was like, what were you thinking? What were you thinking? She goes, I saw your insides. I'm like, well, that's good. Nobody else did. So it's been a struggle. I haven't been that nice guy. She's learned a lot along the way, and she's struggled as well. And she's become more stronger for it, more resilient. We bonded together that way. And she was tough enough to go toe to toe with me and stand there and stare me down and make me, she won't take credit for it, but make me get help. Make me see that I needed to get help and take action, because nobody can help me but me. You know, she put me in a position where I realized that and had to get to work.
Mm-hmm. Good. So would you say, what was your number one struggle that you had, your trial? I know we just talked about a bunch of things, but the biggest trial you've had in your life, and how have you overcome it, or are you still working on it?
It'll be lifetime. I try to explain what they are. I used to say just anger outburst or rage is my biggest thing, you know, but it's the anger outburst that happen when you instantly feel embarrassed, scared, threatened, challenged, or unappreciated. You know, all those feelings that instantly make me feel worthless. They don't, but that's how I allow them to react on me. And that's been the hardest, because that turns into rage. And when you don't start at a 0 to 10, I started a 7, you know, I lived at a 7, and most people live at 7s that were in the military. Like, they're already jacked up, ready to go. They're already ready to point out what's wrong. They're already ready to fix something broken. So they're always on the ready. So it's easy to get to a 10 from a 7. So the hardest thing for me was the awareness that I live at a 7 and I need to back that down, and that it was biological. You know, I kept blaming myself and the shame. Everything I did was so shameful. Why can't I stop? And finally, a brain doctor had explained to me, a guy who didn't know me, he lived out in LA, and he's one of the top brain doctors. And I had some brain scans before and after a procedure that I've done that helps with that behavior. And he said, this is a remarkable change over a 2-day period. He goes, the first day, your brain looks like an NFL player that's been playing for 15 years, you know? And I'm like, of course it does. It's bright red and shiny and it sparks everywhere. I don't know. He goes, so you must have the issues with rage. You must have issues with saying things you don't want to say and you can't stop yourself. You must have issues with feeling inferior, blah, blah, blah. Just laid it out and I was in shock. And I thought, this is not an invisible wound of war. You can take that away now because that makes everybody think, well, it's invisible. You can't work on it. You can see it on a brain scan. It's like a broken bone. You can fix it. And he laid out, I can fix you with over-the-counter supplements. You know, it wasn't more medication. It wasn't more treatment. So I've taken that and realized that, wow, you can get better once you have that awareness that you're not broken. It's not just something. It's not a disorder. I don't like the post-traumatic stress disorder. I like that it's an injury or that it's just post-traumatic stress. All right. It is a bit of disorder when you take things out on other people. Sure. It's you know, but it's really an injury versus a disorder. I can't get anybody to come to get help when they think it's a disorder. If they think it's an injury, they can fix it. They'll come get help. So that's semantics. But that was my hardest struggle was realizing that, well, was being that person that raged and then the shame of what I would say or do to my spouse. And then that shame cycle would keep going and I would beat myself down more until finally the time would come. I would feel a little better. Then would get better again. And then it would have a good relationship. And then I'd blow up and it's all over again. I'm going to die. And so that cycle used to be hours. And with the work, it would become once a day. And then it was, once a week. And now it's maybe once in 6 months or whatever, you know, I'll have a freak out and I won't know why, but I catch it a lot quicker. We recover quicker because we use the tools that we've learned from our coaches and what we've been through to manage that versus letting it just spiral out of control.
Right. And you know, one thing that is interesting, I want to ask you about when somebody is in a fit of rage like that, especially our veterans who've had either PTS or TBI, then instead of escalating it, which I have seen a lot of spouses do, especially if they didn't know their military veteran or a spouse or loved one before, you know, if they didn't know them before their injury and they didn't really realize that that is an injury, it's not actually him just being a jerk, right? Instead of escalating the situation, what are some things that you notice can help calm you down? I mean, for my husband, it's more like you just leave him alone. You let him go. He goes and puts a cover, like a blanket over his head, and he goes on the couch. and so I just learned to just leave him alone. Like, don't say anything, just walk away and just leave him figure it out himself for a while and then go back to it later.
That's something each couple has to determine what works for them. We have fight, flight, and freeze, right? So I'm a fighter. My wife's a fleer. So I'm going to pursue and she's going to retreat. And so if she retreats, that's almost power for me. I've learned not to, right? The awareness of what I'm doing is my point is we all do something different. So we all need to be aware of what that is. And if what we do spirals out of control, we need to stop that. It's not that easy, but we need to take actions and steps that would remove that kind of behavior. Determine what it is that works, you know, and me and my wife have had these conversations, you know, we make rules about when we fight, here are the rules, not if, but when we're going to fight and here are the rules we should stick to because when we don't, it gets out of control. Just like if we're going to go drink, you know, we don't drink at all anymore. We drink no more than I'll drink no more than three in a night. If I drink and she'll drink no more than two, because we know now 4 leads to 20, you know, and then it's no good. So being aware of what you're doing and being aware of who you are personality wise, if you're a fight, flight or freeze person, and to stop that and realize that most couples are fight and flee. But some are fight and fight and some are flee and flee. And both those are just as bad because nothing gets done. We both in a relationship, we all want to feel safe, secure, attached and connected to someone. Right. And so when that breaks down, we start feeling, oh, I want to get that back. So some of us start screaming, reaching out for that hug. I just need to hug you to make it better. So you need to determine what it is that works in your relationship. Set those boundaries and rules and follow them. And that takes time to follow them. That way, when you do spiral out of control, you know, I can leave you there. I will leave you there until you're better. Some people chase, you know, he always leaves and goes out and works on the car and I want to fix it. Well, what happens when you go out there? We fight more. I know, right? Not what you're trying to stop fighting. The whole point is to remove emotions from what's happening. and get back to the facts. And when you're flooded emotionally, you're going to fight. You can't control emotions. They make no sense. They make no sense. So you have to let those emotions calm down for however long that takes, and then get back to it. I've told my wife, just keep telling me you love me. Because when I'm crazy and raging, I mean, no, don't repeatedly get in my face, because everything that happens too much is going to set us off. And people need to realize that many of us have been trained and rewarded for being aggressive and violent. And that's what kept us alive. So that's what our bodies go back to, that safety of that action, right? So you come home and there's a cup in the sink and the whole house is clean, but you focus on that one thing that's wrong, because that's what we do. We look around and find out what's broken and we try to fix that. Everything in the military, like JMPI, if you're a jump master, you look for what's wrong. That's just what's ingrained to us. When you do an after action report, after work, after a mission, you beat each other up for everything you did wrong because you're supposed to do what's right. You know, we don't pat ourselves on the back for what we did right, which is very wrong in how we do our business. But being aware of how we're trained and how we're taught for that 5, 10, 15, 20 years in the military is way different than civilian life looks at things and tackles problems, because it's different in how they play out. One, you could die. And then here in the civilian world, you're probably not going to die by doing something and arguing, right? So being aware there's not life and death, that you're flooded with emotions, and that you need to determine, do we need to pause? Do we need to work it out right now? You know, or do we need to give you the break? Well, I go over here and work on something until you're ready. And that's different for every couple. So you need to sit down and decide what that is, and then work on sticking to those rules, because nothing happens right away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have a book out. What do you talk about in your book?
Pretty much how screwed up my life was. Pretty much it's a memoir of my life, but it's mostly how I screwed everything up and why it happened to me, and then how I got out of it in the end. And then my wife's book, Arsenal of Hope, kind of continues on with that. A little bit more of how I screwed everything up and what I did and what the bad things I did was, but yet more of how we got back together and how we healed and stayed together. And it's kind of just I really wanted it to be not a book about, look at all the cool stuff I did, because the book's full of bad stuff that I did, things that a lot of people won't admit. But I know that if you get on the dance floor first at that gymnasium and you're the first one out there, people will finally start to join you, right? They just need a little bit of encouragement from somebody else who will do it. I figured, why not me? Why not be first? So throughout my dirty laundry, knowing that many others have the same dirty laundry, and then throughout what I did to get out of that dirty laundry and how to improve my life. And that's kind of my goal, is to let people know they're not alone and that there's a way out if they get to work.
That's really good, because I've seen some people online who are really great, influencers in the military community, and they get afraid to put all of the dirt out there. But then, you know, the trolls, they go after and try to find the dirt on you. This way, like, you just put it out there, everybody can know, and people can move on. And I think it's important to share that, because we all have the dirt. We all have all the crap. And I think the only way to really help one another is to put it out there so that you can share how you've dealt with it and how other people might be able to deal with it too. So I really appreciate that.
It weighs you down. And I put that out on our retreats. Jen and I are at every retreat we run, and we lay our story out there. And it's one of the retreats I was telling people about how good I felt, how I did bad things, but I feel good now because I shared them with my wife. I told her, I came clean. I don't have to worry about the phone ring and an email coming in or anything else, or anybody calling and going, guess what? You know, I got you. Cause you know, we're public. And so people know, and people want to jump on that. It's sad, but they do. And my wife now knows if something comes up, she'll look at me and go, nope, you know, everything's like, I know, I'm good. I laugh about it because I feel so much better. And I talked about that in a retreat. And then a year later, an individual wrote me and said, hey, during that retreat, I was having an affair. And I was at a retreat with my wife, and I was in the middle of an affair that I had already just ended, but she didn't know about it. And I was horrified. When you told that story about how you never felt better after sharing the truth, he goes, I held on to it. I didn't know it. And finally, one day, he decided to tell her, look, this is fresh for you, but it's not for me. It's months old, 9 months old. But I had an affair, yada, yada, yada. But I have to tell you, you know, of course, it starts all over. That's a very brave thing to do. You could have tried to hide it forever, right? But that stress on him was killing him. Wrote me immediately. He goes, you were so right. He goes, now she's flaming mad and it's going to be a long time, but I am sleeping at night. I feel better. Now she's pissed at me for sleeping at night for the first time in 20 years. However, that's just because she's mad at me, but he knows that he's on the healing path now and they're working on their relationship and they're getting back together more stronger now because of the honesty of it all. And his life is less weighted down.
So where can people find your book and tell us more about who qualifies for your nonprofit? So both of those questions for you.
So you can find my book on any place that sells books, Amazon. You can find it at allsecurefoundation.org if you want a signed copy. They're a little bit more, but that money goes 100% of that money goes back into the foundation. And that'll get you a signed copy. That's for my book or my wife's book, but they're both on Amazon as well. And they're both at other major bookstores. And who qualifies for our retreats? Combat deployed special operations in any capacity, support any capacity. If you're in special operations or you worked with special operations attached, I think there's attached and assigned now, which throws me off, but attached in any capacity and your significant other can attend a retreat. That's combat deployed. And that's because we're looking for the worst affected. For any help and counseling, any special operations, active duty or veteran in any capacity or their family member can reach out to our website and hit ask request a coach button and get a coach within 48 hours to talk to and start scheduling. We keep trying to hire coaches until someone won't wait more than 48 hours to see their first appointment, to have their first appointment with one of ours. Now, if they can't make it, that's on them, but you know, we encourage that. But we want to be able to see somebody within 48 hours. And when we get to a point where we're backed up, we start looking for another coach and we bring them on as quick as we can. And we make sure that people don't wait. Because the things we hear, once people wait, they won't show up later, right? Or if they have to wait, that could lead to something else right away. So we don't want them to wait. We're not 911. We tell people, we get a lot of, hey, help me, he's drinking, blah, blah, I don't know what to do. I'm like, that's not me. That's not what we do. I can't do that. I don't want to take that on. It's too much. I'm not there. I don't know. I'm not trained for that. And so people shouldn't do that. But we give advice all the time. We're on the phone all the time, helping people out, helping them understand that it's okay. It's not, it is a big deal, but it's not that hard to start. And it's so much better when you do start. So we just want people to feel better. And once they do, I mean, that word of mouth spreads that, hey, this works. You know, it's just sharing how you feel and using these tools that our coaches hand out, help you with your emotions and help you with your relationship and help you get past that dark feeling that you have.
That is amazing. Now I'm going to be interviewing your wife. She's going to be on the next week's show. So I'm excited about that. I can't wait to talk to her. Is there anything that you would like to say before we wrap up the show, especially, well, twofold, one for our military vets, but also for those listening who are in the civilian sector, because I do have a pretty big audience on both sides. Those who want to learn about how to better connect with the military community and those in the military community and everybody who listens to Patriotic. So.
Yeah, I would tell everybody that we're all the same, right? We all want to feel loved. We all want to kind of pitch in and help. And if we do have issues, it's because we weren't loved or felt loved. So, you know, I grew up in the military with my son. I didn't raise my son. I was gone all the time, you know, so we're struggling. He's 25. We're struggling to come back together and have a relationship. And it's a lot of work. So you have to be aware of where you are in life. And you have to realize your family really matters. Your family is number one. Your family was the only one that's going to be there when you're done, unless you get rid of them or lose them. Right. And then keeping a family and being in a relationship is a job. If you don't work at it, you'll get fired from it. OK, you have to put effort into your relationship or it won't work out. For civilians, you know, my book, my wife's book, our foundation, the things that we do to help people aren't relegated just to military. So many people have post-traumatic stress, so many from a car wreck, from witnessing car accidents, from witnessing horrible things, from being robbed, from losing parents or children, to salesmen or CEOs that are never home, also have difficulties with relationships at home. So this isn't relegated just for military. These are just tips and advice for how to be a better person, how to live a better life, be a better human, and be in a relationship that thrives, right, and grows instead of just kind of sinks into a boring, well, here we are, morning, breakfast, dinner, good night, honey, wake up and do the same thing over. we all get bored with that. And when we get bored, we look for excitement and we stray. So if you want to keep a relationship, keep it active, keep it fun, right? Be present. And that's what we want people to do. And I think everybody needs to hear that message.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Tom, for being on the show. And one more time, share your website, please.
Our website is allsecurefoundation.org.
And if you're watching, you see it on the screen. If you're listening and you didn't have time to write it down, you can go back into the show notes and find that. I'll have it on my website and I'll be promoting it on all of my social media as well. Tom, thank you so much for your service. Thank you for sharing your story. And thank you for continuing to serve the way that you're serving. It's really, truly inspiring.
Thank you, Pat. I really appreciate it. I don't think I could have it any other way.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Please head over to pattycatter.com for the latest updates on Patty, her talk show, and what she's up to. You can also find her on Amazon TV and Roku, and on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Patty Catter. Until next time.